pours two foam cups full, then has to put them down to grope in his pockets for change. I, finally, toss two quarters in the kitty. "Who was it?" I ask, as we both stand blowing into our coffee cups. "Who said someone else might see you? Mac?"
"Raymond, Mr. Horgan, he said."
"Ah." An awkward silence, although Marty is the kind of kid with whom it seems there would be many. I explain that I am the deputy PA assigned to the investigation of his mother's murder, and that I received his class schedule from the registrar. Tuesday, 1 to 4 p.m., Independent Art Studio. "I just wanted to touch base in case there's something you might be able to add."
"Sure, right, whatever you want," Marty says.
We drift back toward his easel, and he ends up sitting on the broad ledge between the windows. From here, beyond the university, you can see the railroad lines, dug out and gathered over the belly of the city like a large and tangible scar. The boy is looking in that direction, and I stare for a moment, too.
"I didn't know her very well," he tells me. "You heard the story, didn't you?"
As he asks this, his eyes are quick, and I'm not certain if he would prefer that I say yes or no. When I admit my ignorance, he nods and looks away.
"I didn't see her for, like, a long time," he says simply.
"My father can tell you the whole thing if you want. Just call him. He said he'd do what he could to help."
"He's in New Jersey?"
"Right.
I'll give you the phone."
I take it they were divorced. At that, Marty laughs.
"God, I hope so. He's been married to my mother. I mean, Muriel, but I always call her my mother. They've been married 15 years.
He brings his legs up onto the window ledge and looks out over the clustered campus structures as he speaks. After suggesting that I call his father, the boy, in a moment, tells me himself about what's behind him. He has no particular ease about this. His hands are wound about each other in an almost crippled fashion. But he continues without prodding. The story which Marty tells in fits and starts is one of the contemporary era. His father, Kenneth, was a high school English teacher in a small town in New Jersey, and Carolyn was his pupil. "My father said she was, you know, like, real attractive. I think he started going out with her while she was still in school. I mean, they were sneaking around or something. Which isn't Dad at all. He's real quiet. I bet he didn't know two girls when he met her. He never said that, but I bet. I think it was like some big passionate thing, you know? Real romantic. On his end, anyway." Here the boy appears confounded. His estimate of Carolyn is clouded. He clearly does not know enough to even guess at her emotions.
"Her," he says. "Carolyn, you know, my mother. My real mother," says the boy, screwing up his face.
"My father called her Carrie. She had all these brothers, and her father. Her mother was dead. I guess she hated all of them. I don't know. They all hated each other. Dad said her father was always beating the tar out of her. She was real happy to get away from them." The boy abruptly leaves the ledge and approaches his painting, a swirling eye of red. He squints at it, reaches out for one of the tubes. He intends to work while we speak. He does not, he says, know exactly how his parents broke up. When he was born, Carolyn was trying to go to college and was unhappy that she had to quit. His father just says that all hell was breaking loose in those days, and Carrie got caught up in it. She had a boyfriend, Marty says. He is pretty sure of that from the way his father talks. But the father apparently does not dwell on that. The way his father put it is that because of other dissatisfactions, she stopped liking the town, his father, the life she had. "My father says she was too young when they got married, and she grew up and wanted to be something else, and just, like, decided to be it. Dad says it was a big mess. One day she took off. And my father, you know, says it was probably for the best. He's that kind of person. He says stuff like that and means it." This father emerges in his son's words as a kind of Norman Rockwell figure, wise and gentle, with spectacles in his hand and the paper. The kind of man to spend long nights in thought in the parlor, a teacher who always took his students to heart. "I have a son," I almost tell this boy. I would like to think that someday he would feel this way about me. I don't have any idea who killed her, Marty Pohemus tells me suddenly. I mean, I assume that's why you came. Why did I come, I wonder? To see what she was hiding, I suppose, or did not care to tell. To diminish a little further my idea of what I had thought was intimacy. Do you think it was somebody she knew? He asks. I mean, do you have, like, leads or whatever you call it? Clues? The answer, I tell him, is no. I describe the equivocal state of the evidence, the unlocked windows, the glass. I spare him the description of the cords, the non-viable condition of the seminal fluid. This is, after all, his mother, although my sense is that there is little need for care or solicitude. I doubt that Marty's look of nervous bewilderment has anything to do with recent events. Indeed, there is something that makes it seem as if he regards himself largely as an outsider to all of this. Carolyn tried a lot of rape cases, I say. Some people think it might be someone like that. You don't? Murders aren't usually mysterious. In this city, these days, half of them are gang-related. In almost all the other cases, the victim and the killer knew each other well. About half of them are broken love affairs, marriage on the rocks, unhappy lovers, that kind of thing. Usually there's been some kind of breakup in the last 6 months. Generally, the motivation is pretty obvious. She had a lot of boyfriends, Marty volunteers. Did she? I guess. I mean, there were a lot of times she didn't want me around. I'd call, you know, and I could tell somebody else was there. I couldn't always figure out what was going on with her. I think she liked having secrets, you know? He shrugs. I mean, I thought I'd get to know her. That was why I came out here. My dad kept trying to discourage me, but I thought it would be neat. I'm not so interested in school right now anyway. I figured, you go to college, one place is as good as another. Turns out that I'm, like, flunking everything anyhow. Really? Not everything. I can't understand physics, though. I really can't. I honestly am flunking that. A girl with a T-shirt from the world tour of a rock group and a smart-looking set comes through the door and asks if he's seen somebody named Harley. Marty says he hasn't. You can hear a stereo on down the hallway when she goes in and out the door. The boy changes brushes and comes within inches of the canvas as he works. His strokes are achingly small. He goes on talking about Carolyn. I knew she was out here for years. I started writing her letters. Then when I could really get my courage up, I got her on the phone. It wasn't the first time I ever, like, talked to her or anything. She'd call up once in a while, right after the first of the year a lot. Like, she wanted to call over the holidays, but she knew better than to do that. Anyway, she was nice about it. Real nice. Oh, well, that would be lovely. La, la, ta, ta. Real polite, he says, and nods to himself. Civil. That's a word, right? Right, I say. I'd see her. Sundays I saw her a lot. Once or twice I met people. I guess when it seemed to her like the right thing to do, you know. That's how she introduced me to Mr. Horgan. The emotional currents are strong here. It is best just to let the boy go, it seems, whatever my impulse to ask questions. I mean, she was real busy. She had her career and all. She wanted to run for prosecuting attorney someday. Did you know that? I hesitate longer than I should, even in this ungainly conversation. Perhaps my own expression discloses some reflex of distress, for the boy looks at me oddly. I tell him, finally, that the PA's office is full of people who see that in their future. But that does not put him off. Did you, like, know her real good? I mean, did you work with her or something? Now and then, I say. But I can tell from the way his glance lingers that I have failed in my effort to be oblique. You were telling me what happened when you saw her. He waits a moment, but he is accustomed to cooperating with grown-ups, and he turns his attention to his brush, rumming it around inside a little plastic tray. His shoulders move before he speaks. Not much happened, he says, then rears his head of tangled brass-colored hair and looks back at me directly. I mean, she never talked about back then, he tells me, about when I was a kid.
I suppose I expected her to. But I guess she just didn't feature that part of her life, you know? She, like, said nothing.
I nod, and for a moment we are silent, still looking at one another. His eyes again take on that quickened light.
I didn't make any difference to her, you know? She was nice as pie.
Now, but like she didn't care. That's why my old man didn't want me to come out here. I mean, he spent all those years making up for her, saying that it was a time in her life, all that. He never wanted me to feel like she left because of me, but he knew what was going on.
He throws his brush down. If you want to know the truth, Mr. Horgan had to, like, talk me into going to the funeral. I wasn't gonna. I just really didn't feel like it. My own mother.
That's pretty terrible, isn't it?
I don't know, I say.
He takes his canvas down and stares at it near his feet. He seems to recognize and welcome my close observation of him. Young, I think. There is such a tender quality to this boy's discomfort. I speak quietly. My mother died while I was in law school, I say. The next week I stop by to see my father.
I never did that, but I figured under the circumstances.
I motion.
Anyway, he was packing.
Half the household was in boxes. I said, Pa, where are you going?
He says, Arizona.
Turned out he'd bought a piece of land, a trailer, and he never said word one to me about it. If I hadn't come by that day, I'm sure he'd have left town without even saying goodbye. And it was always like that with us. Sometimes that's the way things are between parents and kids.
The boy looks toward me for a long moment, mystified by my candor, or the things of which we speak.
And what do you do about that, huh?
Anything?
You try to grow up, I say,
in your own way. I have this son, and he's the world to me.
What's his name?
My son?
Right.
Nat?
Nat, says Carolyn's son. He looks at me again. What was she to you, anyhow? I mean, this isn't just work, right? Was she like your girlfriend, too?
I am sure that he has seen my wedding band. His gesture toward me with his chin as he asks this question seems almost to point in that direction, but I do not feel capable of further devices with this soft, decent boy. I am afraid at one point she was my girlfriend, too.
Late last year, I say. Just a little while.
Yeah, says the kid, and shakes his head with real disgust. He's waiting to meet somebody she didn't gull, and there is nobody here who can make that claim.
When I flunk out, he says to me, I'm going home.
This declaration has sufficient weight that it seems to me, perhaps, this matter has just now been decided. But I do not respond. He does not need me to tell him he is correct. I smile, warmly enough, I hope, to show how much I like him. Then I leave. Chapter 8
In the hall, you know,
says Lip, referring to McGrath Hall, the police department headquarters,
they're calling this thing Mission Impossible.
He means our investigation of Carolyn's murder.
That's how the dicks are talking. You know, what's new with Mission Impossible? Like nobody ever figured this fucking thing out. Not in time for Horgan. He never should have let the press think we would come up with something fast. He should have downplayed it instead of giving 40 fucking interviews about how hard we're working.
Lip's mouth is full of torn bread and red sauce, but that does not stop him from complaining. His irritation is extreme. We are standing before a vacant lot, a dump of sorts, beneath the highway viaduct. Broken pieces of stressed concrete with the snaky, rusted coils of reinforcement sticking from them litter the uneven ground, along with the more ordinary refuse, bottles, newspapers, abandoned auto parts. There is also a snowfall of white wax paper balls and crushed cups left by the many customers who have preceded us in taking a sandwich from Giacalone's across the street. It is one of Lip's favorite places, an Italian stand where they insert an entire veal chop laden with marinara into a Vienna roll.
Leprenzer likes heavy fare at lunchtime, the single man's answer to the ennui of dinner. Our soft drinks rest on the backless remains of a public bench on which each of us has perched one foot. Various street gangs and adolescent lovers have inscribed their names in the planks of the bench's punky seat. Walking back to Lip's car, we trade information. I talk about my visit with the kid and the fact that he provided no meaningful leads. Lip discusses his own recent activities. He interviewed the neighbor who said she thought she saw a stranger.
Mrs. Kropatnik, Lip says. She's a winner. Talk some? I'm telling you.
He shakes his head.
She'll look at mug books, but first I gotta get some earplugs.
How about the index? The index is the state file on sex offenders.
Nothing,
Lip says.
Nothing like the ropes? This lady I'm talking to tells me she read something like that once in a book. No one she knows of ever done it. Christ, can you imagine that's what she's reading? You'd think she gets enough on the job.
Lip has his customary OPV, official police vehicle, a gold Aries, unmarked but for the black-wall tires and the license plates, which, like those on every other OPV, begin with ZF, thus forming a code recognized by every minor hoodlum in the city. Lip guns away from the curb. Coppers, cabbies, people who live in their cars always drive so fast. He swings through one of his many shortcuts back downtown, and, because of a detour, is forced onto Kinbark, main drag of my old neighborhood. The diverted traffic is thick, and we move with processional slowness down the avenue. There it is, I think. There it is. His cousin, Milos, who bought the bakery when my father left, never even changed the sign. It still says Savages in a heavy sea-blue script. Even though I work there every day, I remember only certain details of the interior. The summertime screen door that transfigured the moving shapes of the street. The racks of blue metal trays behind the counter. The heavy steel cash register with its round clang. When I was six, my presence was first demanded. I was a pair of hands, unemployed, and not requiring pay. I was taught to break and stack the smooth, white-sided cake boxes. I made them a dozen at a time and brought them from the cobwebbed basement to the store. Because the boxes were so slick and substantial, their edges had, at certain angles, the lacerating power of the finest cutlery. My knuckles and fingertips were often cut. I learned to dread this, for my father regarded a trace of blood on the outside of a cake box as a scandal.
"Is not here a butcher shop?"
This remark would come with a look that mixed loathing and disgust in fearsome proportions. In my dreams of those times, it is always summer, when the air of this valley is as stilted as a swamp's, and the added dry heat of the ovens made it labor just to walk about the shop. I dream that my skin is slick with sweat. My father is calling, a cake has fallen, and my fear is like an acid that is corroding my veins and bones. If I were to paint my father, he would have a gargoyle's face and a dragon's scaled heart. The channels of his emotions were too intricately wound upon themselves, too clotted, strangulated, crowded with spite to admit any feeling for a child. There was never any question of picking sides for me. Like the apartment, its walls and pictures, the furniture he broke, it was clear that my father regarded me as a possession of my mother's. And I grew up with what seemed a simple understanding. My mother loved me. My father did not. He took his satisfaction, if you could call so arid a feeling by that name, from opening the shop, firing the oven, raising the shade, pushing the whitened dust out of the back door at the end of the day. His family had been bakers for four generations, and he simply did as he had been taught. His standards were unyielding, and his procedures were exact. He never tried to charm his customers. He was far too humorless and insular for that. In fact, he saw every person who entered as a potential enemy, someone who would complain, chisel, wheedle, and finally settle for day-old bread. But his income was always steady. He was known to be reliable. He distrusted employees and did the work of two at least himself. And he did not file a tax return for more than 20 years. He had come to this country in 1946, I was named for the town in which he had been raised, a village 200 miles from Belgrade. Almost everyone there was a partisan. When the Nazis came through in 1941, all the adults were lined up against the schoolhouse and shot. The children were left, abandoned. My father, then barely 18 and soft-faced enough to have been spared, roamed with a band in the mountains for almost 6 months before they were captured. He spent the rest of the war in camps, first the Nazi labor camps, and the Allied DP camps after the liberation. His relatives here arranged his passage, hectoring their congressman and the congressman's local staff in a ceaseless and eccentric way. My father was one of the first of the displaced persons allowed to enter the United States, and after a year here, he no longer spoke to my great-aunt and my cousins who had worked so hard to save him. Hearing the rough chorus of auto horns, I look back to make out the problem. A white man in the car behind us pounds on his steering wheel and makes a belligerent gesture in my direction, and I finally realize that Lip has stopped dead in the traffic. I take it that he has surveyed my line of sight and let the other cars move on, but when I turn to catch his expression, his eyes have shifted and he is making a determined effort to study the traffic. "Hair and fiber come in," Lip says finally. His gray eyes, his lined, high-cheeked face betray nothing. Quiet as a pond. "Tell me," I say, and Lip dutifully recounts the contents of the report. On Carolyn's clothes and body were minute fibers of a carpeting not found in her apartment. Zorak 5 is its name. It is a synthetic, milled domestically. The color is called Scottish Malt, the most popular shade. The dye lot cannot be identified, and the fiber could be from either an industrial or a domestic weave. In all, there are probably 50,000 homes and offices in Kendall County from which the carpet fibers could have come. There are no hair or skin fragments in Carolyn's fingers or under her nails, confirming that there was no struggle before she was bound, and the only human hair not Carolyn's shade found anywhere near the corpse has been made as female, and thus insignificant. The cord with which she was bound is regular clothesline, American-made, sold in every Kmart, Sears, and Walgreens. "That didn't get us very far," I tell LaPranzer. "Not very," he answers. "At least we know she didn't grab anybody." "I wonder," I say. I keep thinking about what we said last week, how maybe this was some guy she knew. I remember when I was in law school, everyone used to pass around this case about a guy whose life insurer refused to pay out. His widow was bringing the suit, which was a real stitch, because it turned out this character had bought it whacking off while he was hanging himself, literally. Head through a noose and everything. He cashed in when he knocked over the stool he was supposed to land on. "Oh, shit," LaPranzer laughs out loud. "Who won the case?" "The insurance company, as far as I remember. The court didn't think it was a covered risk. Anyway, maybe that's what this was all about. You know, big-time kinkiness. I'm thinking that more and more. Apparently it's some weird high coming while you're passing out. Well, how does she end up dead from getting hit? Maybe her stud gets scared, thinks he's cooled her, figures it's John Belushi all over again, and starts to make it look like it was something else." Lip shakes his head. He doesn't like it. "You're stretching," he says. "I don't think the PATH report supports it. I'm going to run it by Painless anyway." This reminds LaPranzer of something else. "Painless called me a couple of days ago. Says he's got a report back from the forensic chemist. From the way he sounded, I take it we didn't get much, but maybe you can pick it up whenever you get there. I got to get out west today. Show Mrs. Kropotnik some pictures." He closes his eyes and shimmies his head like maybe, if he tries, he can stand the thought. We are back downtown now. Lip eases into the first open space in the police lot, and we trek back through the noontime crowds toward the county building. Out on the street, our spring, as so often happens, is turning fast to summer. You can feel some of the balminess that is a month or two away. It has inspired some of the ladies passing on the avenue to summer fashions, sleeveless tops, and those light, clingy fabrics of the season. "Brother," I tell Lip suddenly, we are really nowhere. He makes a sound. You ever get the fingerprint lab? I swear, I knew I forgot something. You are a Class A fuck-up, he says. They ain't gonna do it for me. I asked twice already. I promise I will do that as well as see Painless today or tomorrow. When we get back to my office, I ask Eugenia to hold my calls and I close the door. I pull the B-file that Horgan gave me out of my drawer. Lip studies it a moment. The B-file, as I received it from Raymond, consists in its entirety of a login slip produced when the case was entered in our computer system, a single sheet of sparse notes in Carolyn's hand, and a Xerox of a long letter. There is nothing in the file to indicate whether an original of this letter was received, or this copy is all that came in. The letter is typewritten and clean, but it still does not look professional. The margins are narrow, and there is only a single paragraph. The author is someone who knows how to type, but seemingly does not do it often. A housewife, perhaps, or a professional man. I have read the letter 4 or 5 times by now, but I read it one more time, taking each page from Lip as he finishes. Dear Mr. Horgan, I am writing to you because I have been a fan of yours for many years. I am sure that you didn't know anything about the things that are making me write this letter. In fact, I think you would want to do something about them. Probably there is nothing you can do, since all this happened a long time ago, but I thought you would like to know. It happened while you were PA, and it's kind of about somebody who worked for you, a deputy prosecuting attorney who I think was taking bribes. 9 years ago this summer, a person I will call Noel got arrested. Noel was not this person's real name, but if I told you his real name, you would go to him first to talk about a lot of the things I am saying in this letter, and he would think about it and know I turned him in. Then he would hurt me to get even. Believe me, I know him real well, and I know what I am talking about. He would make me very sorry. Anyway, Noel got arrested. I happen to think that what it was for isn't real important, but I will tell you that it was something which he was very embarrassed about because that is the kind of person he is. Noel thought that if the people he worked with and hung out with found out, they wouldn't have anything to do with him. Great friends. But that's Noel. The lawyer he got told him he should just admit it in court because nothing was going to happen and nobody would ever know about it. But Noel is a very paranoid type person, and he ran all over the place fussing about what would happen if anybody ever found out. Pretty soon he started saying how he was going to pay somebody off. I thought he was joking around at first. Noel would stoop to anything, but it just didn't sound right for him. If you knew him, you would understand why. But he kept telling me he was going to do this, and it would cost $1,500. I know all this because, to make a long story short, I'm the one who gave him the money. Since Noel is like he is, I thought I'd better be sure it was going where he said. We went all the way out to the North Branch at Runyon and 111th. Out there, we didn't wait even a minute when a secretary, who seemed to know Noel, walked up and took us downstairs to the PA's office. Your name, Raymond Horgan, was written right on the door, I remember. Noel told me to wait outside. I was too scared by then to fight about it, which was pretty dumb since I came all the way out there to see him give somebody the money. But anyway, he wasn't inside 2 minutes and he's back out. He had put all of his money in a sock. I'm not kidding. And when he came out, he showed me the sock and it was empty. I just about ran out of there, but Noel was very cool. I asked him later what happened. Noel never liked to talk about this thing. He said he was protecting me, which is a laugh. I'm sure he just figured that if I didn't forget it, sooner or later I'd want the money back. Anyway, he did say that the girl took him into an office and told him to wait at a desk there. Then a man talked behind him. He told Noel just to put what he brought in the center drawer of the desk and to leave. Noel said he never looked back or anything. 10 days later, Noel had to go to court. He was just about crazy again. He kept saying he knew he was going to get screwed over and everything. But when he got there, the lawyer from the prosecuting attorney told the judge that the case was dismissed. I have tried and tried to remember this lawyer's name, but I can't. Once or twice I asked Noel the name of the guy he bribed, but like I said, he really never liked to talk about this and just told me to mind my own business.
So, I am writing this letter to you. I haven't seen Noel in about 2 years. Frankly, this is not the worst thing he ever did, by a long shot, if you believe him, but it's really the only thing I ever saw him do myself. I'm not really out to get Noel, but I thought that this PA was really wrong for taking this money and taking advantage of people that way, and I wanted to write to you so that you could do something about it. A couple of people who I have told this story to without using any names said that you couldn't do anything about something so old since the statute of limitations is passed, but I figured this couldn't have been the only time something like this ever happened, and maybe even they're still doing the same thing. Actually, I think that what I just wrote isn't true. I hope you get Noel, too. But I don't want him to know you got him from me. And if you do get him from someone else, I beg you, please, please, not to show him this letter. I am trusting you.
The letter, of course, is unsigned. Our office gets letters like this every day. Two paralegals are assigned to do pretty much nothing but answer this kind of correspondence and talk to the various cranks who wander into the reception area in person. The more serious complaints tend to get passed along, which presumably is how this one found its way to Raymond. Even at that point, a lot of what comes in is junk. But this one, for all its funny twitches, has the ring of the real thing. It is more than possible, of course, that our tipster was simply scammed by his friend Noel, but the guy who wrote the letter was in the best position to judge, and he doesn't seem to think that was the case. Scam or not, it is easy to figure out why Raymond Horgan would not want this file floating around in an election year. Nico would love to have evidence of any kind of undiscovered crimes committed during Raymond's regime. As the letter writer surmises, it is not likely that friend Noel's case was an isolated episode. What we have in hand is a first-class scandal. An unnoticed, worse, unapprehended bribery ring operating in one of the branch courts. Lepranzer has lit a cigarette. He has been quiet a long time. "You think it's bull?" I ask.
"Nah," he says, "something's there. Maybe not what this jamoke thinks, but something."
"Do you think it's worth looking at?"
"Can't hurt. We ain't exactly buried in Leeds."
"That's what I thought." "Carolyn figured these guys were gay," I say. "I think she was probably on the right track." I point to her notes. She has the section number of various provisions of what is still titled the Morals chapter of the State Criminal Code written down, a question mark beside them. "Remember the panty raids out in the public forest? That would have been right about then. We were busting those guys in carloads, and the cases went to the North Branch, didn't they?"
Lip is nodding. It all fits.
The embarrassing nature of the crime, the mania to conceal it, and the timing is right. Sexual crimes involving consenting adults were ignored as a matter of policy in Raymond's first administration. The cops brought in the cases, but we gave them the shuffle. By the time Raymond began to campaign for re-election, certain groups, prostitutes and gays particularly, were in their more florid segments, largely beyond control. With the gays, the problem was acute in the public forests, which ring the city. Families would not go there at midday on the weekends for fear of what their children would be exposed to. There were some fairly graphic complaints about what was taking place in broad daylight on the picnic tables, where, Mom tended to point out, people were supposed to eat. With the election 9 months away, we made a large show of a concerted cleanup. Dozens of men were arrested every night, often in flagrante delicto. Their cases were usually disposed of with court supervision, a kind of expungible guilty plea, and the defendants then disappeared. That is the problem. Both Lip and I recognized it would be difficult to find Noel. There were probably 400 of these cases that summer, and we don't even know his name. If Carolyn made much progress, the file does not seem to show it. The jacket date indicates she got the case about 5 months before her murder. Her notes reflect little investigation. Noel is written in an upper corner and underlined countless times. A little farther down the page, she has written Leon. The significance of this eluded me at first. Then I realized that she had assumed that, like many aliases, the name chosen by the letter writer was the product of some meaningful association. Maybe the name was a rebus. Carolyn was going to suppose she was looking for somebody named Leon. Finally, she has another name, Keneally, at the foot of the page, and his assignment. This is Lionel Keneally, a good copper, now a commander. We work the Night Saints cases together. He runs the watch in the 32nd Police District, whose cases are heard in the North Branch. I still don't understand why I never heard about this case, I tell Lip. I can't imagine a procedural reason for not informing me, or for the case to have ended up in the hands of Carolyn, who did not work in our public corruption unit. I have spent more than a few moments with that puzzle, full as it is with sorrowful implications about my fading romance with Raymond Horgan, and his with me. Lip shrugs. What's Horgan tell you? I haven't been able to corner him. It's 12 days to the election. They're on a 24-hour operation now. How about Keneally? What'd he say? He's been on leave. Well, you better talk to him. He ain't telling shit to me. We ain't in each other's fan clubs. The police department is full of people with whom LaPranzer does not get along, but I would have guessed Lip would take to Keneally. He likes good cops, but there is something between them. He's hinted at it before. Lip starts to leave, then steps back in the office. I am already headed out to see Eugenia, but Lip takes me by the elbow to detain me. He closed the door I just opened. One thing, he says. He looks right at me. We got our muds back. And? Nothing great. Only we wanted to get muds on any number she called more than 3 times in the last 6 months. Yeah? I noticed as I'm going through there, one of the numbers that comes up that way is yours. Here? I ask. An especially narrow look emerges from Lip's narrow, Slavic face. Home, he says. Last October. Thereabouts. I'm about to tell him this could not possibly be right. Carolyn never tried to reach me at home. Then I realize what it is. I made those calls from Carolyn's place. Lying to my wife. Late again, kid. This trial's going to be a bitch. I'll catch dinner down here. Lip watches me calculate. His eyes are flat and gray. I'd just as soon you let it go, I say at last. If Barbara sees a subpoena notice from the phone company, she'll blow a gut. Under the circumstances. If you don't mind, Lip, I'd appreciate it. He nods, but I can see that it is still not right with him. If nothing else, we have always depended on each other to be above certain base kinds of stupidity, and Dan LaPranzer would be unfaithful to that compact if he did not take one more moment to cast his gray eyes on me harshly, so that I know I've let him down. Chapter 9 In the end, I told Robinson, we had to put Wendell McGaffin on the witness stand. His testimony was the only effective response to his father, and so we called the boy in rebuttal. Carolyn was splendid. She wore a dark blue suit and a beige blouse with a huge satin bow, and she stood beside Wendell, whose feet did not reach the floor from the hard oak chair in the witness box. You could not hear a thing in the courtroom. And then what did your mother do, Wendell? He asked for water. When your mother took you in the basement, Wendell, what did she do? It was bad, he said. Was it this? Carolyn went to the vice, which had sat throughout like an omen at the edge of the prosecution table, grease-smeared and black, thicker in all its parts than any of Wendell's limbs. Uh-huh. Did she hurt you? Uh-huh. And did you cry? Uh-huh. Wendell drank some more water and then added, a lot. Tell how it happened, said Carolyn, finally, softly, and Wendell did. She said to lie down. He said he screamed and cried. He cried, Mommy, don't. He begged her. But he finally laid himself down, and she told him not to scream. Wendell swung his feet as he talked. He gripped his doll. And as Carolyn and Mattingly had instructed him, he never looked over at his mother. On cross, Stern did what little he could, asked Wendell how many times he'd met with Carolyn and whether he loved his mother, which caused Wendell to ask for more water. There was no disputing, really. Every person there knew the child was telling the truth, not because he was practiced or particularly emotional, but because somehow in every syllable Wendell spoke there was a tone, a knowledge, a bone-hard instinct that what he was describing was wrong. Wendell convinced with his moral courage. I delivered the closing argument for the county. My state of personal disturbance was such that when I approached the podium I had no idea of what I was going to say, and for one moment I was full of panic, convinced that I would be speechless. Instead, I found the well of all my passionate turmoil, and I spoke fervently for this boy, who must have lived, I said, desperate and uncertain every moment, wanting, as we all wanted, love, and receiving instead not just indifference or harshness, but torture. Then we waited. Having a jury out is the closest thing to life in suspended animation. Even the simplest tasks, cleaning my desk, returning phone calls, reading prosecution reports, are beyond my attention, and I end up walking the halls, talking over the evidence and the arguments with anyone unlucky enough to ask me how the case went. About 4 o'clock, Carolyn came by to say she was going to return something to Morton's, and I volunteered to walk along. As we left the building, it began raining hard, a cold downpour driven almost sideways by the wind, which was full of winter. People dashed down the street, covering their heads. Carolyn returned her merchandise, a glass bowl whose source she did not identify, and then we headed back into the rain. She more or less shouted out as the wind came up, and I put an arm around her protectively, and she leaned against me beneath my umbrella. It was like something coming loose, and we went on that way for a few blocks, saying nothing, until I finally followed my impulse to speak. "Listen," I said. I started again. "Listen." In her heels, Carolyn was about 6 feet, an inch or so taller than me, so it was almost an embrace when she turned her face in my direction. In the natural light, you could see what Carolyn, with her devotion to lotions and gyms and spectacular fashions, tried to obscure, that it was an older face, past 40, the makeup clinging to the lines radiating from her eyes, a haggard roughness now part of the skin. But somehow that made her more real to me. This was my life, and this was happening. "I've been wondering," I told her, "about something you said. What you meant the other night when you told me, 'not now.'" She looked at me. She shook her head as if she did not know, but her face was full of caprice, her lips sealed to hold back her laughter. The wind came up again then, and I drew her into the shelter of a recessed storefront. We were on Grayson Boulevard, where the shops faced the stately elms of the Midway. "I mean," I said, hopeless and pitiable and small, "there seems to be something going on between us. I mean, am I crazy to think that?"
"I don't think so."
"You don't?"
"No."
"Ah," I said. Still smiling wonderfully, she put her arm through mine and moved me back down the street. The jury returned a little before 7 o'clock. Guilty on all counts. Raymond had remained in the office awaiting the verdict, and he came downstairs with us to meet the press, cameras not being allowed above the lobby of the county building. Then he took us out for a drink. He had a date, and so around 8:30 he left us in the back booth at Caballero's, where Carolyn and I talked and became drunk and moony. I told her that she had been magnificent. Magnificent. I don't know how many times I said that. TV and the movies have spoiled the most intimate moments of our lives. They've given us conventions which dominate our expectations in instants whose intensity would ordinarily make them spontaneous and unique. We have conventions of grief, which we learned from the Kennedys, and ordained gestures for victory by which we imitate the athletes we see on the tube, who, in turn, have learned the same things from other jocks they saw on TV. Seduction, too, has got its standards now, its slow-eyed moments, its breathless repartee. and so we both ended up coming on smooth and wry and bravely composed, like all those gorgeous, poised movie-time couples, probably because we had no other idea of how to behave. And even so, there was a gathering in the air, a racing current that made it difficult to sit in place, to move my mouth or lift my glass to drink. I don't believe we ordered dinner, but we had the menus, something to stare at, like coquettes with their silk fans. Beneath the table, Carolyn's hand was laid out casually, very close to my hip. I didn't know you when this started.
What? She asks.
We are close on the plush seat, but she must lean a bit nearer because I am speaking so softly. I can smell the liquor on her breath. I didn't know you before this case, before this started. That amazes me.
Because?
Because it just doesn't seem that way now, that I didn't know you.
Do you know me now?
Better. I think so.
Don't I?
Maybe, she says. Maybe what it is that now you know you want to get to know me.
That's possible, I say, and she repeats it. That's possible.
And will I get to know you?
That's possible, too, she says,
if that's what you want.
I think that is, I say.
I think that's one thing, she says, that you want.
One thing?
One thing, she says. She brings her glass up to drink without looking away from me. Our faces are not very far apart at all. When she puts her glass down, the large bow on her blouse almost brushes my chin. Her face seems coarse with too much makeup, but her eyes are deep and spectacularly bright, and the air is wild with cosmetic scents, perfume, and body emanations from our closeness. It seems as if our talk has been drifting like this, circling languorously, like a hawk over the hills, for hours.
What else do I want? I ask.
I think you know, she says.
I do? I think you do.
I think I do, I say. But there's one thing I still don't know.
There is?
I don't quite know how to get it,
what I want.
You don't?
Not quite.
Not quite? I really don't. Her smile, so arch and delicately contained, now broadens, and she says,
just reach.
Reach?
Just reach, she says.
Right now?
Just reach.
The air between us seems so full of feeling that it is almost like a haze. Slowly I extend my hand and find the smooth edge of her bright satin bow. I do not quite touch her breast in doing that. And then, without turning my eyes away from hers, I gradually tug on that wide ribbon. It slides perfectly, and the knot breaks open so that the button at her blouse collar is exposed, and at just that moment, I feel Carolyn's hand fluttering up beneath the table like some bird, and one long fingernail skates for an instant down my aching bulge. I almost scream, but instead it all comes down to a shudder, and Carolyn says quietly that we should get a cab. So, I said to Robinson, that was how my affair began. I took her back to her fashionable loft and made love to her on the soft Greek rugs. I just grabbed her the minute she set the bolt in her front door, hiked her skirt up with one hand and put the other down her blouse. Very suave. I came like lightning. And afterward, I lay on top of her, surveying the room, the teak and walnut and the crystal figurines, thinking how much it looked like the show window of some Tony shop downtown, and wondering in this idle way what in the fuck I was doing with my life. Or even in a life where the culmination of a long cultivated passion passed so quickly that I could hardly believe it had happened at all. But there was not a lot of time to think about that, because we had a drink and then went to her bedroom to watch the story about our case on the late news. And by then I was capable again. And then, that time, when I reared up over her,
I knew I was lost.
Chapter 10 Whatever I could do for you, Rusty. Anything you need.
So says Lou Balestrieri, the police department's commander of special services. I am sitting in his office in McGrath Hall, where the PD's central operating sections are housed. I can't tell you how many Lous there are over here. 55-year-old guys with gray hair and guts that hang on them like saddlebags. Phlegmy voices from smoking. A gifted bureaucrat, ruthless with any person in his employ, and a shameless toady to anyone, like me, who has sufficient power to harm him. He is on the phone now, calling down to the crime lab, which is under his control.
Morris, this is Balestrieri. Get me Dickerman. Yeah, now. If he's in the can, go in there and get him off. Yeah.
Balestrieri winks at me. He was a street cop for 20 years, but he works now without a uniform. His rayon shirt is sweated through under the arms.
Dickerman, yeah. On this Polhemus thing, Rusty Savage is over here with me. Yeah, Savage. Savage, for Christ's sake. Right, Horgan's guy. Chief Deputy. We got a glass or something.
Yeah, I know they're latents. I know. That's why I'm calling you. What do you think?
Right, I'm a big dumb Goomba. Right, and don't fucking forget it. This big dumb Goomba can send you home with your nuts in a paper bag. Right?
Right.
But why I'm calling is this. Can't we do a computer scan with that laser thing against our knowns?
Yeah, you got 3 good prints there, right? So get what you need and run them through the computer, and let's figure out if they're anyone we know.
I hear the cop on the case has been asking for 10 days now you should do this.
Murphy?
Yeah, which one? Leo or Henry? Because Henry is a horse's ass.
Good. Well, tell him to un-onload it.
Don't give me the computer crap. I don't understand that shit anyway.
No, no, not good enough.
All right. Call me back. 10 minutes.
10.
Let's figure this thing out.
The problem, as it gradually emerges, is not equipment, but the fact that the computer is under another section's jurisdiction. The department owns only one machine, and the people who do things like payroll believe it should be regarded as theirs alone.
Right. I'll ask, says Balestrieri when he gets the return call.
He covers the receiver.
They want to know how big a field you want to run against. We can do all felons or all knowns in the county. You know, everybody who's ever been printed. County employees, shit like that.
I pause. Felons is probably enough. I can do the rest later if we ever need it. Balestrieri makes a face.
Do it all. God knows if I can get back on.
He takes his hand away before I get a chance to answer.
Do all of it.
Yeah.
How soon?
What the fuck is going to take a week?
This man's running the biggest murder case in the city and he's got to kiss your ring?
Well, fuck Murphy's statistical analysis.
Yeah, tell him I said so.
Right.
He puts the phone down.
A week, probably 10 days.
They got to get the payroll out. Then the chief needs some statistics for the LEAA, Law Enforcement Assistance Administration.
I'll push, but I doubt you'll see it any sooner.
And have your copper get the glass back out of evidence and bring it to the lab, in case they need it for anything. I thank Lou for his help and head down to the pathology lab. This building looks more or less like an old high school, with varnished oak trim and worn hallways. It is coppers wall to wall, men, and more than a few women these days, in deep blue shirts and black ties, bustling around and making jokes with one another. People of my generation and social stratum do not like cops. They were always beating our heads and sniffing for dope. They were unenlightened. So, when I became a prosecutor, I started from some distance behind, which, in truth, I have never made up. I've worked with policemen for years. Some I like. More I don't. Most of them have 2 failings. They're hard, and they're crazy. They see too much. They live with their nose in the gutter. 3 or 4 weeks ago, I stayed longer than I should have on a Friday night at Gill's and began buying rounds with a street copper named Palucci. He did a beer and a shot a couple of times and started talking about a heart he had found that morning in a Ziploc bag. That was all, just the organ and the major vessels, lying right next to a garbage can at the end of an alley. He picked it up, he looked at it, he drove away. But then he made himself come back. He lifted the lid of the can and stirred the rubbish. No body parts.
That was it. I done my duty. I dropped it off downtown and told him to mark it goat.
Crazy. They are our paid paranoids. A copper sees a conspiracy in a cloudy day. He suspects treachery when you say good morning. A grim fellowship, nurtured in our midst, thinking ill about us all. The elevator takes me to the basement.
Dr. Kumagai, I greet him.
His office is right outside the morgue, which lies beyond, with its stainless steel tables and the ghastly odors of open peritoneal cavities. Through the walls I can hear a surgical saw screaming. Painless's desk is a mess, papers and journals in ramparts, overflowing wooden trays. Set at one corner, a small TV is on, the volume low, with an afternoon baseball game.
Mr. Savage, real important stuff, huh? We got Chief Deputy with us.
Painless is every kind of weird. A 5'5" Japanese, with heavy brows and a small mustache divided over the middle of his lip. A kinetic type, always dodging and twisting, talking with his hands in the air. The mad scientist, except there is nothing benevolent about him. Whoever got the idea that Painless would be best off working with stiffs pushed him in the right direction. I can't imagine his bedside manner. He is the kind to throw things at you, cuss you out. Whatever bitter little notion is in his brain will find expression. He is one of those people of whom the globe at moments seems so full. I do not understand him. If I try very hard in that sort of instinctive effort we all make at pseudo-telepathy, my screen comes up full of fuzz. I cannot imagine what is passing through his mind when he does his job, or watches TV, or turns after a woman. I know I could lose a bet even if I had 10 chances to guess what he did last Saturday night. Actually, I just came in to pick up a report. You called Lepranzer.
Oh yeah, says Painless. Right here somewhere. That fucking Lepranzer. He wants you to call right away with everything.
Painless works two-handed, transporting the stacks of paper across his desk as he seeks the new report.
So you won't be chief deputy too much longer, huh? De La Guardia, I think, gonna kick Raymond Hogan in the ass, huh?
He looks to me to respond. Painless is smiling, as is his custom when dealing with something that others find unpleasant. We'll see, I say. Then I decide to be a bit more aggressive.
Delay a pal of yours, Doctor? Nico's hell of a guy, hell of a guy. Oh, yeah. We work on all kinds of big murder case together. He's good, too. Real good. Yeah, he get up there. He really kicked those defense lawyers in the ass. This is this thing.
He tosses a file folder in my direction and bends toward the TV.
That fucking Dave Parker. Now he only got dope in one nostril, really hitting a goddamn ball.
The association between Nico and Painless had eluded me before, but it's a natural. The big-time homicide prosecutor and the police pathologist. They would need each other badly from time to time. I ask Painless if I can sit down for a minute.
Sure, sit.
He moves a stack of files and looks back to the television. Lepranzer and I have been kicking over this theory lately. Well, let's say idea. Maybe this was some weird bondage thing that got out of hand. Maybe Carolyn was living dangerously, and when her beau thought she had expired, he gave her a whack on the head to make it look like something else. Does that sound possible? Painless, in his white lab coat, rests his elbows on the turrets of papers.
No fucking way.
No?
No fucking way. Coppers, dumb,
says Painless, the police department pathologist.
Something hard they make easy. Something easy they make hard. Read the fucking report. I write a report, fucking read it. Lepranzer wants me, hurry up. Then he don't read the fucking report.
This report?
Not that report.
He swipes at the new report when I hold it up.
My report, autopsy. You see anything with bruises on wrists? Bruises on ankles? Bruises on knees? This lady is dead from getting hit, not strangled. Read the fucking report.
Well, she was tied up pretty good. You can see the rope burn on the neck in the pictures.
Oh, sure. She was tied up real tight, real good. Looked like a fucking bow and arrow when they brought her in. But you got one mark on the neck. Somebody jerking the rope tighter and tighter rope's gonna move. Get a wide bruise. She got one skinny little mark on her neck.
Meaning? I asked. Painless smiles. He loves to hold the cards. He pushes his face close enough to the TV that the gray gleam of the screen is reflected on his brow.
First and third, he says.
What does it mean that there's a narrow mark? I ask again. I wait. The TV announcer declaims over a line drive.
Do I need a subpoena?
I ask quietly. I try to smile, but my voice has some edge.
What?
Asks Painless.
What do you make of the bruises on her neck?
I make that rope was tightened there first, okay?
I take a moment to gather this in. As Painless knows, I'm lost. Time out, I say. I thought the working theory was that somebody hit her to subdue her. The blow was lethal, but our guy doesn't realize that or care. He ties her up and rapes her with this bizarre slip-knotting, so he's strangling her at the same time. Have I got it right, or have you changed your mind?
Me change? Look at fucking report. Don't say nothing like that. I'm not saying that. Looks like that, maybe. Maybe that's what coppers think, not me.
Well, what do you think? Painless smiles. Painless shrugs. I close my eyes an instant. Look, I say, we're 10 days into a big deal murder investigation, and I hear right now for the first time that you think the rope went around her neck first. I would have appreciated knowing that a while ago.
Ask! Lipranza, call me up. Hurry up. Need a report. Okay, he got a report. Nobody asked me what I think.
I just did. Painless sits back in his chair.
Maybe I don't think nothing, he says.
Either this guy's a bigger douchebag than I even remember, or something is way out of line. I deliberate for a moment, working backward. Are you telling me you think she was raped and then tied up?
Tied up last, yeah. I think that. Raped? No, I'm thinking no.
Now?
Now,
says Painless. We stare at each other.
Read the report, he says.
The autopsy?
This report, this fucking report.
He hits the folder I'm holding. So I read the report. It is from the forensic chemist's office. Another substance in the vagina of Carolyn Polhemus has been identified. It is known as nonoxynol 9. From the concentrations, the chemist concludes that it derived from spermicidal jelly. That is why there were no viable spermatozoa. Painless is smiling hugely and without generosity when I look up again.
We're saying this woman used contraception? I ask.
Not saying. She did. Contraceptive jelly. 2% concentration. Cellulose gum base. Used with diaphragm.
Diaphragm. I'm extremely slow. You missed a diaphragm during an autopsy?
Fucking no!
Painless hits his desk. He laughs at me out loud.
You bit an autopsy, savage. Slice her right open. No diaphragm in that lady.
More time. Painless smiles and I watch him. I'll bite.
Where'd it go? My guess?
Please.
Somebody took it.
The cops?
Coppers ain't that dumb.
Who?
Look, Mr. Savage, ain't coppers. Ain't me. Gotta be the guy.
The killer?
Fucking A right.
I pick up the report to read it again. When I do, I notice something else, and our conversation suddenly comes clear. I try to steady myself, but my temper is rising. I can feel the heat all the way to my ears. Perhaps Painless can see that, because after baiting me for 10 minutes, he finally levels. He probably figures that sooner or later I would get it anyway.
You want to know what I think? I think it's a setup. This man who kills her is her lover. He comes over, has drinks. This lady has intercourse with man, okay? Real nice. But he's angry guy. Picks up something. Kills her. Tries to make it look like rape. Ties her up. Pulls out diaphragm. That's what I think.
What does Tommy Molto think? I ask him. Painless Kumagai, the sadistic little shit, has finally been cornered. He smiles insipidly and tries to laugh. Laugh is actually not the right word. He wheezes. His mouth moves, but he does not speak.
I hand him the report back, which, I notice in passing, is dated 5 days ago. I point out his own handwritten note at the top. It says, Molto, 762-2225. Don't you want to copy this down? Make sure you can reach Molto when you need him? Painless is gaining speed again. Oh, Tommy! He does better at seeming genial. Good guy, good guy. How's he doing? Oh, good, good. Tell him to give us a call sometime. Maybe I can find out what's happening in my own fucking investigation. I stand up. I point at Kumagai. I call him by the name I know he detests. Painless, you tell Molto and Nico, too, that this is cheap. Cheap politics and cheap police department bullshit. God better help them and you that I can't make a case for tampering. I snatch the report from Painless's hand and leave without waiting for an answer. My heart is hammering and my arms are weak with rage. Raymond, of course, is not in when I get back to the county building, but I tell Loretta to have him reach me. It is urgent. I look for Mac, but she, too, is elsewhere. I sit in my office and brood. Oh, how fucking clever. Everything we asked for, and nothing more. Give the results, but not the opinion. Call when the forensic chemist reports, but don't mention what it says. Let us run as long as possible in the wrong direction. And in the meantime, leak every goddamn thing you know to Molto. That's the part that gets me worst. God, I think politics is dirty. And the police department is dirtier. The Medici did not live in a world fuller of intrigue. Every secret allegiance in the community comes to bear there. To the alderman and your bookie and your girlfriend.